Court. My name is Michael Mandelman, and I represent the defendant, Gene Bode, in this matter. I will be addressing a number of issues before this court, those primarily dealing with Wisconsin Statute 940.24, causing injury by the negligent handling of a dangerous weapon. Our assertion to the court in this matter is that it was misinterpreted and misapplied and should not have been applied to Mr. Bode in this matter. Further, this is a crime heretofore unknown in Wisconsin law. This is the first time that without the active participation of a defendant in the matter, that an owner has been held accountable in a criminal matter, and that therefore there are substantial public policy issues before this court. Regrettably, we were only able to get the figures for the number of dogs within the counties of both Milwaukee and Waukesha. Both cities, there are approximately 47,000 dogs in those two. Extrapolated to the entire state of Wisconsin, there would be approximately 187,000 dogs or more within the state of Wisconsin. That means potentially the decisions reached today could have substantial impact under the somewhat loose definitions that have come down in this case as to each and every one of them. In the particular case before us, Mr. Bode was traveling outside the state of Wisconsin. He had no notice of a substantial issue of what was going on back in Forest Junction where this attack occurred. In fact, he was almost 200 miles away when this occurred.
Did he have somebody dog sitting or not? You gotta feed him.
Yes, Your Honor. There were people that were taking care of the dog. An interesting point in this case is that none of the people who were supposedly watching the dog at the time were charged as party to the crime, as is potentially were the statute to be upheld. They could have been.
Mr. Mandelman, can I follow up on that just a little bit? The people that were dog-sitting, if you will, were they just coming over on occasion to feed the dogs, or what was their responsibilities?
Your Honor, with all due respect, the record is not complete in that respect, and I would have to add substantially of my own account, which I am unwilling to do. There were people that were responsible for feeding the dogs. Exactly what their role was or how often they were, I would have to add to the record, and therefore I can't answer.
All right, thank you.
Suffice it to say, though, that there were people that were responsible for the dogs while they were away. Even more salient and very critical for our considerations is the fact that Mr. Bode had taken a number of positive steps as to the care of those dogs. The dogs were, according to Mr. Bode, they were on double choke collars, number one. And number two, in addition to that, they were behind a chain link fence. Even the sheriff's deputies called to testify in this matter testified that upon going over to the property and examining it after they'd learned of the attack on the victim in this matter, they were, I cite the record, Investigator Pagel testifies that Bode used metal stakes to hold down the bottom of the chain link fence, as well as electric wire and boards around the base of the fence. It is really critical for us to consider what sort of affirmative duty we are going to wind up imposing on someone if we are going to allow dogs almost per se under the definition handed down to be considered as dangerous weapons. How far must the owner of a dog's responsibility go as to criminal responsibility in taking care of those dogs?
Come, Mandelman. If I could just interrupt for a moment. We get at least two problems here. One is statutory, namely, Your client was convicted under 940.24, which is what, dangerous instrumentality? Dangerous weapon, explosive?
Fire or
okay.
Otherwise, or knife.
Pardon me?
Or knife.
Okay. rather than some of the other statutes, right? So we have to figure out if your client falls within the statute. Is that right? I'm sort of trying to narrow down the issues.
I think, Your Honor, that's correct. What's very interesting.
And then the second issue is, even if you we get to where your client is within the statute, whether or not there's sufficient evidence in this case, right?
I agree, Your Honor.
So what are the issues under the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I think the primary issue that we have to deal with, there's two primary issues. First of all, those set of circumstances, and I think the court in the advance sheet in this correctly addresses it, those circumstances under which a dog can be considered a dangerous weapon, and number two, whether in fact 940.24 should ever be applied in that matter because of the construction of 940.07, the one dealing with homicide by negligent control of a vicious animal. I think that those are two things.
Well, where does the Sinks case fit in?
Well, Sinks case, Your Honor, is fascinating because of the fact that Sinks case involved a sexual assault, and one of the interesting points of the case is I don't know that it was ever made very clear. There were two instrumentalities that were used in the Sinks case, one of which was a knife, and the second of which was a dog, which was told to guard the poor victim in that case. In that case, you also had the immediate proximity of the defendant, and I think that there is certainly some argument that can be made that in that particular case, because you had the active use of the animal, that it in fact was being used as a dangerous instrument.
How do you say active use? Is that what you're...
Yes, Your Honor. The active is the defendant in that case instructed the dog to guard the victim, number one, and number two, the defendant had also instructed the victim that the dog had been used before to chase a burglar, therefore advising it of its dangerous propensities. The victim in that case testified that she had fear of her life were she to have left the scene.
Mr. Mandelman, just a couple of questions. You talked about public policy. Obviously, the legislature sets public policy. This court has, and probably will in the future, set public policy. You have to look at each case. Now, it's obvious under 940.24, it doesn't mention dogs. However, there is a judicial note coming from the Judicial Council that when you talk about dangerous instrumentalities, this should be a broadened or more expansive than limiting. Now, from a public policy standpoint, you say we shouldn't do it, the legislature should do it. My question to you is, under these facts, do you say, well, there's 147,000 dogs or 46,000 dogs in those two counties, or obviously this isn't going to apply to all of those cases, but under this set of facts, with the known propensities that have been testified to, why couldn't we simply apply the statute to this case and say that's it? This is where we're drawing the line in the sand. From a public policy standpoint, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think that that's addressed by the fact that where we're drawing the line in the sand, number one, has substantial issues with it. The definition of a dog as a dangerous weapon has substantial problems with it. The legislator to my understanding, I don't believe the legislature ever intended that it be under this particular set of facts. The reason being that in this case, we talk about the propensities of the dogs. If we look at the record in this case, it's addressed, as much is made of the fact that Mr. Boda had in fact advised the local sheriff's department of the fact that these were watchdogs. It is a substantial, and I believe almost a unrealistic logistical leap to go from dogs being guard dogs or watchdogs, as they are characterized in his letter, to being a cat dogs. Someone could have a 15-pound poodle in their home, and that dog could be a high-strung dog. It could yelp a lot. Under the definition handed down, if it chased neighbors or had in fact had attacked a dog. And I note that in the record, if I'm correct, I believe that it was made mention that the dogs had attacked another dog, but they're only chased children. You know, how are we drawing the line there? That means that a dog without a prior history of actually having attacked a person that is caged, that is behind a double chain link fence, and is also got electric wire around it, is by its very nature a dangerous weapon. I think that that's the real danger in it.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm still a bit confused. I assume that your argument is twofold. One, that a dog can never be a dangerous weapon.
That is not accurate.
Okay. So that's why I wanted to clarify that. It is your position, then, that your client can come in under 940-24, whoever causes bodily harm to another by negligent operation of a dangerous weapon can include a dog. I mean, if that's your position, then we can go into the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. But, so that's what I want to know. I want to know what's your position. Now, your position can be in the alternative. One, no dog can come under 940.24, but if the court should hold against you, this dog can't. So I'd like to just know your legal position.
I think, Your Honor, in fact, I am arguing in the alternative. I am arguing in the alternative. Number one, I don't think that 940.24 was ever intended to include dogs.
Okay.
Number two, I think that more importantly, and I think, again, referring back to what we talked about earlier, and as I'm stating in the advance sheets, it's trying to come up with a two-part definition. Number one, those set of circumstances under which a dog may be considered a dangerous instrumentality. And secondly, how, if we get to that first point, it can then be applied. You know, we have to remember that so far to date, the legislature did not see fit to include a 940.24. One of the biggest problems that I have, and even the Court of Appeal has in this case, is they talk about attempting to limit their definition of this to the owners of dogs who intend their dogs to be dangerous weapons. Getting back to what I said earlier, it is a substantial leap to go from the sinks
type. I'm still going to just raise another issue. On the legal question, if we should hold your way that a dog never comes under 940.24, then I assume we'd have to overturn sinks.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that if you have the proximity of a defendant in an area, and that defendant actively urges a dog to either attack an individual.
Stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry, I will. To actively attack an individual and is present there, I think you have a different situation. Here we are talking about the negligent use. One of the first principles that we were taught in law school is mens rea, some intent. And even the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals deals with the intent to use as a dangerous weapon. I'm simply saying that the logistical gap between, and the failure, number one, to really have a clear definition of when a dog is a dangerous weapon, which I posit to this court, must actually be under circumstances requiring the active participation and proximity of a defendant to it. And then number two, to even begin to, were we to hold that a dog is in fact or can be a dangerous weapon, number two, that the mere fact that a dog is a watchdog means that it is or can be improperly handled, I think is just too substantial to be able to do.
But Mr. Mandelman, in an analysis in this type of case, the first thing we have to decide is whether or not a dog can be a dangerous instrumentality under 940.24. And then the second question, if that is the case, then was it used as a dangerous instrumentality? You keep seeing, in answer to the Chief's questions, you seem to keep flipping into the second part of that issue, but I don't see how you can. If we are going to say that a dog can be a dangerous instrumentality under 940.24, we have to overrule sinks.
Your Honor, why
don't we have to?
I don't.
Sinks held that a dog can be a dangerous, quote, because we conclude that a dog can be a dangerous weapon.
Correct, Your Honor. don't think that with 940.24 we're talking here about negligence, not intent to use. I think that those are substantially different.
Counsel, 940.24 uses the word dangerous weapon. 939.2210 defines dangerous weapon.
That's correct.
And the last aspect of dangerous weapon is any other device or instrumentality which in the manner it is used or intended to be used is calculated or likely to induce death or great bodily harm. That's where the intent comes in. It seems to me you could take the position. I'm not urging you to take the position. You might not, it might not be a good position. But you could take the position that a dog never falls under sub 10 as a dangerous weapon, intent or otherwise. That the dogs are under different sections. You either come under 940.07, which is control of a vicious animal, or you come under 174.02, which is civil liability, or you come under some other statute, but you never fall within dangerous weapon. That could be your position. That's a legal position. That ends the case if you should win on it. Dogs don't come under that because your client was only charged under 940.24. Your other position, which I think is a sufficiency of evidence issue, is dogs can be an instrumentality when they are intended to be used or calculated or likely to produce death or great bodily harm. And that's a sufficiency. So I keep asking you, which one is your position? And you can argue in the alternative.
As I said, Your Honor, I think that there are certain circumstances under which a dog may be a dangerous weapon. But it is strictly under circumstances where the dog, and because of the prior definitions already handed down, is actively urged to do something. There is some mens rea of the defendant, but only under that very, very narrow thing. Because otherwise, as I've addressed previously, it is the public policy problem that we have about setting the rest of the standards. The court addresses the issue about the line drawn in the sand. Under, were we to allow this case to go forward, the potential exposure is so substantial for so many people. You know, Sinks again, and Sinks being the lead case, although People versus K was another type of case, a Michigan case, which dealt with where a dog was used during some shoplifting. You know, again, you have active participation. And even in the court also discusses 940.07. It's interesting that that also requires that the victim in that case have taken all steps. It would be easier under this definition to, or it would be impossible, even were the defendant to have died in this case, than to convict Mr. Botta for the death, but possible under the definition handed down by the Court of Appeals to convict him of the crime. That makes no logistical sense.
Counsel, is there any merit in the argument, I'm asking you, that you can define dog as a dangerous weapon, as Sinks did, for purposes of first-degree criminal sexual assault, but that it should not be defined as a dangerous weapon under 940.20, but the legislature did not intend it to be defined as a dangerous weapon under 940.24, injury by negligent handling. Is there any substance to that assertion? Can you make that distinction?
I think that the distinction goes to the heart of what I've been arguing to the court, that it would go back to the very fundamentals of what we're trying to address. It's active participation, the presence of the defendant, and it's not really the dog.
Okay, let me interrupt you, if I may. So you're saying that a dog is never, I'm asking you this, you're saying a dog is never a dangerous weapon for purposes of 940.24, injury by negligent handling of a dangerous weapon, explosive or fire. But a dog can be a dangerous weapon in other situations, and those situations would include a situation like Sinks, which deals with first-degree criminal sexual assault. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And I realize some of the potential issues that that in itself can raise. But without that differentiation, in one case we're talking about a criminal and an intentional act, and in the other case, we are talking about a situation where it is the mere negligence of someone in the supposed handling of this that creates the problem. And that's why I think it is so important for us today to be able to clearly define that set of circumstances under which a dog is in fact a dangerous weapon and those circumstances under which it is not.
When, what's your understanding of when the state is asserting the crime was committed under 940.24?
Well, that raises an interesting thing because...
That's why I'm asking the question.
There are two things that are absent here. Theoretically, under the state's interpretation of this case, a dog trainer, because if a dog trainer, separate distinct from the owner, had in fact trained the animal, and in fact had trained the animal for the dog, for the owner to be an attack dog, then that trainer could also be held responsible.
Well, but the answer to my question is, what then? When was the crime committed? When that trainer...
According to, as the definition came down from the Court of Appeals, it would be when Mr. Boda had, number one, created a dangerous weapon, which I do not believe that he in fact did, and number two, they also assert when he failed to take adequate steps at the very conclusion, there's substantial inconsistency here.
What does the complaint allege as to the date of the crime? When did the crime occur? When did the defendant commit this crime?
According to the complaint, Your Honor, and forgive me if I'm inaccurate in this, but I believe the crime in fact occurred, and it was stated to have occurred on the actual date that Mr. Burns was attacked. Not at some time previous, but on the date that the crime occurred, Mr. Boyle was in Chicago, 200 miles away, and did not nor could have in any way participated or known as to what was going on. That is the very, very substantial issue that it raised.
Can you clear up for me as to what is the purpose of guard dogs? I've only had dogs in the past that would help the burglar take the furniture off. What is the purpose of a guard dog?
I think the purpose of a guard dog, Your Honor, is to alert the owner that there's something going on in the premises and that the clothes of the premises have been broken, or to alert him that there's something untoward going on at that time.
Mr. Mandelman, and I'll ask Mr. Posner-Weber the same question. Sinks was mandated in 1992 when we refused the petition. To accept the petition. Has there been any legislative activity in the area since then?
Your Honor, not to my knowledge.
Did you check?
Again, Your Honor, I don't have, to my knowledge, and I had my law clerk do it, and I forgive the court, so I'm not giving necessarily a clear answer. There has been nothing legislative which has come down which would aid us in our deliberations today as to attempting to define what in fact is a dangerous animal and under what circumstances a dog can be so defined as a dangerous animal.
Here, the answer to my first question intrigued me. If it's to alert the owner isn't even here, so he's leaving guard dogs there by themselves to warn whom?
Well, whoever would be present on the premises, Your Honor, but that gets back to the 93905 issue of party to a crime. Of who do we wind up charging and under what circumstances?
Prosecution doesn't have to charge everyone.
I'm not suggesting that the prosecutor does, Your Honor. I'm simply saying that the logical extension of the problems created by the somewhat loose definition of this case, where we say that a dog, by the very nature of being a guard dog, creates it as a dangerous weapon. And secondly, having defined handling as simply, as it is in this case, I believe, loosely defined as failed to adequately train the dog or trained it in some aggressive propensities. There was no testimony about the training as to aggressive propensities. There was the evidence as to its use simply in the letter that was sent to the Sheriff's Department.
Mr. Mandelman, let me, if I might interrupt for a minute. Wasn't there testimony by an expert for the state in regard to the fact that Rottweilers normally, Rottweilers that are trained normally are not going to attack human beings, but that those that are untrained could attack indiscriminately?
Yes, and there absolutely was testimony to that effect. But the interesting issue is there is not a scintilla of evidence in this, that these particular dogs were trained. There's a difference between a lack of training.
I thought that the point that the expert was making was just that these dogs had not been trained, that somehow or other they were guard dogs or watch dogs, as your client characterized them, but that there had been no real training of these dogs.
I'm not sure that that's inaccurate. I think that she was talking about the general propensities of Rottweilers and not as to these specific ones. To my understanding, the record only addresses the issue that these dogs were, in fact, supposed to be guard dogs. I've got this one.
Thank you, Mr. Mann.
Thank you, Kurt.
Yes, sorry. I'm sorry.
Question.
Justice Presser.
If you were a prosecutor and a similar case came along, not involving this defendant, is there any section of the criminal code that you would have looked to?
No, Your Honor. And if the court would like me, I will address why. There, as the court is aware, and much of it has been made, particularly in the dissent, there is a specific statutory section, and that is the civil negligence one, 174.02, that deals with such situations. Mere negligence has always been addressed and has been addressed and hopefully will be addressed for time immemorium to come as a matter of civil liability. I don't think that we have carried the criminal law to the state yet where we are going to extend it to mere negligence, and in this case I believe the negligence of Mr. Botta, to the extent that it even may exist, was ordinary negligence. And I would posit to the court that Mr. Botta, in fact, and it is even acknowledged by the Court of Appeals, and this is that he took extra precaution to wind up restraining these dogs. The problem is the logistical nightmare created. There's no fair notice. There's no clear definition of what there is. Mr. Botta did not know nor could have known that his conduct in any way would have been criminal in nature. And I think that the legislature clearly intended, under unbelievably egregious circumstances, the ones dealing with the death of a human being by 940.07, there is a methodology for dealing with it. But a mere dog bite, I don't think that they ever meant to do. And that, in fact, I think that it's strictly the civil liability. This does not even... This is different, though, from the Sinks-type definition, where a dog is used as part of an actual attack. That's different from when a dog simply attacks someone. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Attorney General Gregory M. Posner-Weber, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Greg Posner-Weber. I represent the state as the respondent in this appeal. The state asks this court to hold first that Section 940.24 was properly interpreted and applied against Mr. Botta. Second, we ask this court to hold that the trial evidence fully supports his conviction for the charged crime of causing injury by negligent use of a dangerous weapon. The state agrees with the chief's characterization of the two problems in this case. We'd answer the first question by saying, yes, the statute was properly applied. We'd answer the second question by saying, yes, the evidence fully supported the verdict. The state's position is set forth in its brief is that Section 940.24 may properly be applied against Mr. Botta because in the absence of limiting language, a statute must be understood to apply to all situations reasonably included within the ordinary scope of its terms. That's language quoted in the state's brief from State versus Badmarowski. The fact that this statute may be applied in this admittedly unique fact situation demonstrates the statute's breadth. The state respectfully submits that this court cannot rewrite the statute to exclude this particular fact situation. The state understands Mr. Botta's core contention to believe that the legislature didn't intend Section 940.24 to be used in fact situations like this. The paucity of that argument is proven by the fact that there is no legislative history to support Mr. Botta's position. There's no persuasive reason to believe that the legislature intended to exclude fact situations like this one from the operation of Section 940.24. The statute itself contains no limiting language. Dogs or animate objects are not excluded from operation of the statute. And as Justice Wilcox pointed out in his questioning, the legislative history of this statute actually shows a broadening of the applicability of the statute.
Okay, I want to just touch on that because I was thinking, this is a dog case. As I see around the state of Wisconsin, people, this is a farm state. You have the bull in the pasture. Known propensities for being vicious has perhaps acted up. you have a exotic animal, a bull elk, which could escape the pinning and then could possibly harm some human being. Maybe I'm getting too far afield, but once we put our stamp of approval, you know, this is the old slippery slope argument, but basically I could see where if a bull in the pasture broke through the fence, the next thing you'd have an expert saying you had to have four fences because it was this bull and you had to have a concrete pillar and the bull should have never been in the pasture, etc. So what do we do with that type of situation where this is, in my opinion, or would be a broadening or expansion? And what do we say, no, it only applies to dogs? Well, I don't think it would be difficult to do that, because any animal, certainly a, as I mentioned, a bull elk or a bull, or even someone having some other exotic tame lion or mountain lion or something like that, and it was chained, it got through the fence. What would you say about that situation?
I would say that the Court of Appeals drew the line that we need to look at. The Court of Appeals read into the statute a scienter.
We're having trouble hearing you. I'm sorry.
Am I? I think the Court of Appeals dealt with that issue when they wrote or read a scienter requirement into the statute. The court said we look at the intent of the defendant. And that's how they separated out Mr. Bodo's situation from the situation that perhaps thousands, hundreds of thousands of dog owners in Wisconsin might face. There may well be 100, 200,000 dog owners in this state, but there was only one guy who intended his dogs to be used as dangerous weapons in this case, and that was Mr. Bodo. Now, the state freely admits that there are two issues in this case, sufficiency of the evidence and applicability of the statute. Our position is that if you conclude that this statute was properly applied against Mr. Bodo, and we believe it was, that the evidence was there, the evidence was sufficient for a reasonable jury to conclude that the man intended the dogs to be used as dangerous weapons. I want to segue here to a point that the Chief and Justice Bablich both made. I don't think, the state doesn't think, that you can have a different definition of dangerous weapon under one criminal statute and another. 939 defines dangerous weapon in a very specific way. I think that if the state loses, if we lose on the definition of dog as dangerous weapon, then Sinks has to be overruled. I don't think
has
to be overruled.
Sinks.
Right. I don't think, if you decide that a dog is not a dangerous weapon under the statute, I don't think that the state in good faith can argue that a different definition should apply based on the criminal statute that's being invoked.
Okay, then for the moment, let's talk about the evidence. Let's take Justice Wilcox's bull. Obviously, in common parlance, that's a potentially dangerous weapon. Most bulls are dangerous. So, if you look at this is an instrumentality which, in the manner it is used, which is on the farm, in the open, but appropriately restrained, they think it's restrained, is calculated. I don't think we have a farmer who's calculating, so I'll eliminate that. So, but is likely to produce death or great bodily harm. So what about that bull, Justice Wilcox's bull? Is it, will it fall into dangerous weapon if it breaks out of its pen?
No, Chief, it
won't.
Why not? Because I didn't grow up on a farm. But it's my understanding that bulls are intended to inseminate cows. They're not intended for use as dangerous weapons. If this farmer trained the bull to attack, if this farmer goaded the bull into attacking, if this farmer took a lead pipe and beat this bull and made it mad and made it angry and trained it to go after people, then we would have a different situation.
Suppose then the farmer is careless about the pen, knows he's got a dangerous bull in there, but the pen really is not adequate to contain this animal that wants to get out. So in the manner it is used, to view that language broadly, is likely to produce death. Are we going to get them under 940.24, or let's take that?
If he intends to use this bull as a dangerous weapon...
He doesn't intend to do that.
Then he's not liable under the statute.
Okay. So now let's take it into the dog case. I've got a dog, and I intend it to be a bodyguard. Work late, get out of the capital, and let's assume there wasn't a rule that didn't allow animals here. And so I bring it in, and I use it to walk me to the car at night, and I intend it to be a bodyguard. I intend it that... it generally be friendly, but only attack when I tell it to attack. Well, it doesn't quite understand the signal and attacks. Am I liable under this?
Then the question would be whether your training was negligent, whether somehow the manner in which you trained this animal could arguably be said to be negligent under the statute. I think potentially you're subject to criminal liability, yes. We'll have to look long and hard at what you intended, and we'll have to look long and hard at what you did.
So instead I have two very friendly, great Irish setters, but then one of them goes screwy one day and attacks a child. Am I liable under the statute?
Not if you didn't intend to use the animal as a dangerous weapon, no.
So then the sufficiency of the evidence here has to be that this defendant intended to use this dog... To inflict harm.
Yes. More precisely, that Bodo intended to use his Rottweilers as dangerous weapons, to use the language of the statute. And the Court of Appeals, as we noted in our brief, very carefully outlined the evidence of record that supported the jury's finding on this particular point. To my knowledge, Mr. Bodo has not contested the accuracy of that evidence. He has stressed the countervailing evidence, which of course is his right, but the existence of countervailing evidence doesn't necessarily mean that the evidence was inadequate as a matter of law to support the conviction. The standards of review favor jury verdicts. If we only had a sufficiency of the evidence question in this case, we might not be here today, because this court's own published decisions say that normally you will not take a case that involves simply the sufficiency of the evidence. I take that as a vote of judicial faith in the jury's parsing out of the evidence of record.
Mr. Posner-Webner, do I understand the testimony of the state's expert, June Ashford, as basically being that the two dogs involved here were not well-trained dogs? In other words, that the defendant intended them to be guard dogs or attack dogs, but that they were ill-trained or not well-trained? Is that the evidence that was presented at trial?
June Ashford testified to two very important points, and her testimony is found at record 127, and the testimony that I'm talking about now is found at pages 180 to 187. She made two salient points. The first was that Rottweilers would not instinctively attack a human being. They would have to be trained or conditioned to do that, and that perhaps speaks to the chief's point about her dog, a dog being trained to attack on command. Ashford also said that improper or insufficient training would lead a Rottweiler to attack indiscriminately. Two possibilities here. A dog is trained to affirmatively go under a given set of circumstances. A dog is poorly trained, inadequately trained, improperly trained, and it attacks indiscriminately. Both of those situations, however, involve affirmative action on the part of the dog owner.
Counsel, when are you asserting that the negligent handling occurred in this case?
Hornbook law and negligence. Duty, breach, cause, harm. When the harm occurred is when the crime was committed, and that's the way the statute is written. Whoever causes bodily harm. This crime was completed when the boy was injured.
The scienter, when did that occur in this crime?
Presumably at the point when Mr. Bodo decided that he was going to be using these dogs as watchdogs. We only have circumstantial evidence as to when he formed that intent. We have a letter that he wrote to law enforcement officers calling these dogs. I believe watchdogs or guard dogs, perhaps both.
Sometimes dogs are trained after, I don't know, how many weeks? A number of weeks, and there's a period for training. And that's when they're trained. And let's say the defendant trained the dog as an attack dog, as is asserted by the state, and 5 years pass without incident, without any kind of attack. In fact, the dog's kind of a nice dog and plays with Jeannie and Jane and Billy and Susan and everyone else in the neighborhood. But lo and behold, one day goes a little crazy, as dogs on occasion do, and bites someone. Is there any temporal proximity requirement for intent in this crime?
Not on the face of the statute. If there was an intervening factor that might raise a question of proof at trial, whether it was in fact the defendant's conduct that led this dog to behave the way that it did, a factual issue might raise a question as to whether criminal liability should attach.
I don't know this answer. Is there any statute of limitations problem? You know, dogs can lead long lives, and they train them within the first year, and 12 years later, there's a bite. That the element of the, because you said, and the Court of Appeals says, the scienter element is required, that is, dealing with instructing to attack, trained to attack, or improperly training so that they attack. Now, this can occur years and years and years. Is there any statute of limitations when an element of the offense occurs outside the statute of limitations? I don't think so. But
That's a question that I'd want really to think about and brief separately if you perceive a problem with it in the context of this case. If you identify the point of the commission of the crime as the injury, when the injury is inflicted, I don't think we have a statute of limitations problem here or in most of these cases. You know, I can think of situations where I might plan on robbing a bank with someone and the plans take time to go into fruition. Crime's not completed until the bank is robbed.
Well, if it's not, crime isn't completed, you can still be charged with attempt, can't you?
Sure, or possibly conspiracy.
Can someone be charged here with attempted negligent injury if the crime isn't completed, that is, if no injury is caused, but just because of the training 12 years ago, they intended the dog be a dangerous dog, why can't they be charged with attempted negligence?
I know that there's case law out there that talks about whether or not a person can be held criminally liable for attempting a negligent act. I'm not prepared to argue in this case whether Mr. Bodo could have been held liable for attempt. My own suspicions, my own gut feelings are that this crime was completed when this boy was injured. Certainly there's never been a question or argument in this case that there's a statute of limitations bar or that somehow the formation of intent, the timing of the formation of intent should have barred criminal prosecution in this matter. I can't help but think that this crime was completed when this boy was injured. The fact that Mr. Bodo formed his intent to use this dog as a dangerous weapon at some point before that injury shouldn't immunize him from criminal liability any more than a delay in the formation of my plans to commit an armed robbery should necessarily keep me out of harm's way on criminal liability simply because the acts weren't completed until some point in the future.
I take it that the negligent handling as such refers to the enclosure and how the dogs were kept, not trained.
The Court of Appeals actually looked at not only the enclosure, the state of the enclosure itself, but also the actual securing of the dogs within the enclosure.
So the negligent handling, I take it, is separate and apart from the training.
Yes.
Boy, I misunderstood that in the Court of Appeals opinion then. Under the statute, and I had a little difficulty with the Court of Appeals opinion, maybe mine, not the Court of Appeals, but the statute requires a negligent operation or handling. The Court of Appeals said, no operation here, we're dealing with handling. And I thought the definition of handling included training under their opinion. What's the handling then? Then their discussion concerning training is...
I think it did, too. I think the court looked at the totality of what we had on the facts here. I think they looked at the scienter element, the intent element, and said Mr. Bodo improperly trained these dogs. And having improperly trained these dogs, Mr. Bodo then went on to not take, I'm phrasing this poorly, he failed to take the appropriate steps to restrain these very large, very powerful, very poorly trained dogs. And in that regard, I believe the court found negligence. A duty not only to train these dogs properly, but to restrain them properly, breached when he trained them poorly and failed to restrain them. Causality, not at issue in this case. Harm, not at issue in this case. If this court wants to bracket the restraint of these dogs and say that this was the negligent act, the state doesn't have a problem with that, because on this record it's abundantly clear that Bodo did not take appropriate steps, necessary steps, proper steps to restrain these animals. We have June Ashford's testimony, as we were discussing with Justice Crooks, June Ashford's testimony that absolutely establishes that these dogs did what they did because Mr. Bodo either trained them to do it that way or improperly trained them, which caused them to act indiscriminately. If you buy into the notion that these dogs targeted this boy, that they were taught or trained to attack this boy, then Bodo's conduct in that regard is culpable under the facts and circumstances of this case. If he negligently, improperly, poorly trained these dogs, and they attacked indiscriminately, we still want to put the criminal liability for that misjudgment on Mr. Bodo. And the state believes there's nothing unreasonable about that. That under these facts, it's manifestly reasonable to hold a defendant responsible for the injuries that resulted.
Counsel, let me take the facts up until the point of injury as exactly the facts we have in this case. But let me give a hypothetical situation. A hypothetical situation that the dog attacked several adults and killed an adult woman. Would that crime be chargeable under 940.07? Would it be egregious enough to be charged under 940.07, homicide resulting from negligent control of a vicious animal?
If we define ordinary care under the totality of the circumstances, yes. I have spent a lot of time thinking about this issue because this is one of the points that came out when we argued this case in the Court of Appeals. Would he, if this boy had died, could this man have been held criminally liable under 940.07? And I believe that depending on how we define ordinary care, if we define it under the totality of the circumstances, the kind of dogs we have, their past history, their ability to inflict injury.
My sense is it would be a real tough case, that's only a sense, because it says ordinary care, as you refer to, is that it's kept without ordinary care. There's a lot of evidence in this case, perhaps it cuts both ways, that there was electric fence around it, there was boarded around it, maybe even the choke collars. I mean, I think it would be a tough case under 940.07, which leads to my concern that if it's not a case that could be brought under 940.07 when there's homicide on these facts, how can it be brought under injury?
First of all, even if, under your hypothetical, even if had this boy died, charges couldn't have been brought, that does not preclude this court, or the legislature for that matter, from somehow devising a logic that would allow a charge to be brought under 940.24 if simple injury had resulted.
My point is, if the defendant's conduct is not egregious enough in my fact situation with a group of adults and a woman is killed, if it's not egregious enough to charge the defendant in that kind of case under 940.07, how can it be egregious enough here?
Were I the district attorney in your hypothetical, I'd charge it. And I'd argue that ordinary care in this context involves the totality of the circumstances. It might be ordinary care to keep a 15-pound poodle on a leather lead. It would not be ordinary care to do that with a 100-pound Rottweiler bitch under the facts and circumstances of this case. Now, in preparation for the oral arguments in this case, I went to the pattern jury instructions looking in vain for a pattern jury instruction on 940.07. There is none. My sense is that were a jury to be instructed on this particular fact situation, if we'd assume that the boy in this case died, that the definition of ordinary care would have to involve the totality of the circumstances. Ordinary care as pertains to these demonstrably dangerous, demonstrably vicious animals. My preference would be to address any remaining issues that the court has. I would advance our arguments on brief.
Mr. Posner-Weber, did you look into the legislative history to see if the legislature has addressed any of this?
Yes, we did, and I see nothing that specifically relates to the statutes that are at issue in this case. This is a marginal argument, and I will make it as a marginal argument. But to my knowledge, the current legislature has not taken any activity in light of BODO, which has been around now for several months. To my knowledge, there are no bills pending to modify Section 940.24 to exclude dogs or to exclude animate objects from the category of dangerous weapons.
And nothing since 1992, since?
Nothing that I've seen since 1992. I looked at the drafting file, and I also had a clerk look at it, and I didn't see anything that specifically relates to the issue before us. The legislature certainly was capable, in light of the Court of Appeals decision, if they had problems with the Court of Appeals' construction of 940.24 in this legislative session, a bill could have been introduced to modify this statute. Our office follows criminal matters very closely. I have not seen any bills introduced that purport to modify 940.24 that suggest that the legislature is somehow unhappy with the interpretation that the Court of Appeals has given this statute.
Mr. Posner-Weber, how do you address the argument of defense counsel in this case in regard to equal protection, the argument tied to selective prosecution?
It doesn't belong in this litigation. Argument wasn't raised in the petition for review. It wasn't specifically raised in the Court of Appeals as an equal protection argument claiming selective prosecution. It doesn't belong in this litigation. If this court disagrees, then Sears, State versus Sears, which is cited in our brief, should dispose of it. A solitary prosecution presents a prima facie case of selective or discriminatory prosecution only when it's coupled with a substantial showing by the defendant that there was a desire on the part of the prosecutor here to prevent the exercise of the defendant's constitutional rights, or that it was motivated by personal vindictiveness. There's no evidence of that here. There's no evidence. There was nothing presented in the record to suggest that this prosecutor was motivated by animus or that there was any effort made here to suppress or adversely affect Mr. Bodo's exercise of constitutional rights. It's a non-issue. It's just a non-issue.
Counsel, I've read the Court of Appeals decision, at least the pertinent part, while I was sitting here, because I was disturbed by Justice Bradley's questions and the response. So I'm looking at your appendix, page 109. We conclude that physical or temporal proximity is not a prerequisite to the statutory crime under the defendant's criminally negligent handling of a dangerous weapon cause the necessary injury. Rather, once it's determined that a person intends the dog to be a dangerous weapon, the person has responsibility to promptly supervise the weapon. The owner exhibits a high degree of negligence in supervising the weapon, and the weapon injures someone as a result of that negligence. There's exposure to criminal liability. In the question she posed about somebody who starts out with what appears to be a dangerous weapon, but apparently changes his or her intent, or the dog doesn't turn out to be dangerous. How would you read this Court of Appeals decision?
that language taken out of context may cover Justice Bradley's hypotheticals, but it doesn't, the language goes to the defendant's defense, which is a little different. So my question is, one, how you deal with that, and you said it was okay if it went to negligent supervision here, namely the pen and the chain. Was the our case argued under negligent supervision?
In the circuit court?
Yeah. Because you've got a jury verdict, and I don't know what the instructions are, and I haven't read the record, so it's not so easy to switch gears.
I would have to go deep into the circuit court record to specify the theory of prosecution. My understanding was that the prosecutor proceeded on two assumptions. One, Bodo intended these dogs to be used as dangerous weapons, 3 points. Two, trained them as such. Three, failed to take appropriate steps to secure them, the fencing, the choke chains. In terms of intent, absence of intent is always a defense to a crime in which there's a specific mental element. If a defendant can make out under the facts of his case that he did not intend a dog or an animal to be used as a dangerous weapon, that's a defense in law. It eliminates one specific element of an offense. That was not the proven circumstance in this case.
How would you improve the Court of Appeals decision? That's another way of stating my issue.
How would I improve it?
Yes.
I'd eliminate all that language that had me arguing things that I didn't argue in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals had some concern that we were trying to impose strict liability on dog owners, and I took that language very personally, and I went over my brief and went over as much of the argument as I could, and found only one possible reference in my brief where I was less articulate than I would have liked to have been. We're not talking about strict liability in this case.
Aside from that, is there anything else that you'd, in terms of the legal argument, does that sentence bother you? We conclude that a physical or temporal proximity is not a prerequisite to the statutory requirement.
It doesn't, because traditionally in negligence law, there doesn't have to be a spatial or temporal proximity. And I cited the cases involving the pellet gun and a couple of other cases from other jurisdictions that note that we don't need that physical or temporal proximity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mandelman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Justice Wilcox addresses an interesting issue. The definition used here.
Could you stand in front of the microphone?
The definition used here, or attempted to be posited here, that a dog can be a dangerous weapon, raises the first concern, which has been addressed in a number of forms by the multiple justices on this court. I wish to remind you that it is, in fact, not the animal which is a dangerous weapon. It is the method by which it is used, and we have two possibilities in the disjunctive, either operated or handled. And as Justice Geske, I believe so correctly, points out, the temporal issues, the proximity to that, raises substantial concerns in this case. And since we have immediate proximity, and I make much of this throughout my arguments today, that we had immediacy, use, and intent. We do not have this here. And I disagree with Mr. Posner-Weber, although very articulately argued, in fact, we are in the process, were this case to stand, of creating a strict liability-type situation. I have heard arguments advanced by my learned opposing counsel today about improper training. Where is fair notice to people as to what constitutes proper training? And relative to the issue of the securing of the property around the dogs, we have a chain link fence, we have double choke collars, we have reinforced wire, and we have boards placed. If that is not at least adequate steps to attempt to prevent the escapes of these dogs, what else can we do?
There is no notice to people, the common owner of a dog, as to what they're going to have to do to prevent them potentially being charged with a felony in this matter.
Counsel, could I ask you a question about the facts, which I don't understand? Wasn't the front gate open or something? What?
Not, Your Honor, without going back to the entire record, not to my knowledge. It's surmised under this set of circumstances that the dogs dug their way out underneath it, and in fact, I believe there was a hole there. I don't have the record in front of me, but I believe that to be factually accurate, and not that the gate was left open. Even were that to be the case, Mr. Botta at that particular time was not there. Were you to, and please excuse the reference, but were someone to leave someone else in charge of their dogs, and they take all the adequate steps potentially necessary to confine those dogs, and that person by happenstance or be it by the dog leaping up and somehow, I mean, dogs are remarkably intelligent animals, and getting the hook on chain so that it escapes through that door, are we then going to charge those people because of that very small period of time that the dog managed to get out? I don't believe that it was ever intended to go that far. And I think that there are some major issues in attempting to do that. Not only that, we can take Justice Wilcox's argument, the logical extension that not only are dogs dangerous weapons, but potentially even cats could be dangerous weapons. Suppose someone's cat got out of the place. Suppose that it had previously scratched a number of people. Suppose that on a particular day, the bad cat goes and it, through the use of its claw, takes out a child's eye. And had the owner known of it? Was it inappropriate for it not to keep it locked up 24 hours? Did the cat somehow escape? Where do we wind up putting an end to this? How far are we going to allow this liability to go? I argue to this court that the current definition is handled down by the Court of Appeals and is allowed to be, creates an almost strict liability.
But the Court of Appeals specifically rejected the argument that you are just now making.
I disagree because I think that the Court of Appeals, and I will tell you where I think it is inconsistent. It says at page 10 that there is no evidence that Botta trained his dogs to attack, and there is evidence that he intended to use the dogs as dangerous weapons. That's at page 110. They then say, and they point out, that the focal point of our holding is that 940.24 requires a person to use or intend to use as a dangerous weapon.